Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Archbishop of Dublin, Diarmaid Martin, thanks so much for inviting us into your home here this morning in Drumcondra.
Thank you. It's my home for a short period, because I'd be moving on. I'm beginning the process of moving. I have made a very, very strong resolution never to collect so much rubbish and books and objects and vases that I'll never do it again, because although I effectively live in two rooms here, I'd be moving into a smaller presbytery. It'll have five rooms, but those five rooms would probably fit into one of the rooms in this house. They're all very, very big. But you know, it's very strange. Yesterday I was putting up books, and I suddenly realised that those books constitute various parts of my life. I get these books and I say, no, I bought those. You know, why did I buy those books at a particular period of time? And I bought them, you know, because I was fascinated in Africa in one stage, or sort of political questions, or I'd gone to there. And then you open them up and you find dedications from people that you've completely forgotten about. You know, and some people of significance, so that part of your life is on the bookshelves.
As we sit here in the palace in Drumcondra, you know, I can hear sirens outside, but you were telling me a little while ago about all the beautiful little creatures that live in your garden.
Well, there's a garden here, and we have squirrel races every day where they're fighting or chasing one another. We have magpies by the hundred, seagulls which nested and were actually very aggressive. Occasionally a heron will arrive.
Wow.
We had hawks who eat other birds in front of you. Foxes have dug a little passageway for themselves to come in. This morning we had a hare. The hare appears occasionally. And I'm a bit worried, because they tell me that rabbits and hares can have about 82 children in a year. And the last thing I want is my successor to come in and he wouldn't even have a shotgun to deal with them. You know, I grew up in the city. I'm a city person. I mean, I always lived in cities or worked in cities. But my mother, who was a Dubliner, had a fear of animals. She had a fear of dogs, and she had a terrible fear of cows.
Yeah. Why cows?
Well, because of a little incident that when my brother was small, they were in Buncrana, and a cow panicked and got into the house. And she was there on her own with my brother in her arms. And it was a polished stone floor you'd have in a, and the cow began slipping. And she went over to a window, opened it, put the baby out, and there was a man passing by, she'd take the baby. But when it all calmed down, they said to her, you know, we've been trying to open that window for years. And it shows you the strength of a mother.
Yeah.
To defend a baby. But she didn't like cows after that. You know?
For good reason.
Yeah.
Go back, you mentioned your childhood there. Yeah. Tell me where you grew up and about your family.
I was born in Dublin. I was probably conceived in Derry, because I have a Northern Ireland wartime identity card issued a week after I was born, with a residence in Northern Ireland. My mother was determined to come to Dublin so I'd be born a Dubliner, and that I'd be born not under foreign occupation. It was a political gesture. But, you know, we grew up in difficult circumstances. We lived in a tenement for some time, because you couldn't get a house. I remember going every 2 days to the office of the Lord Mayor, Alfie Byrne, to try and see, could you get a corporation house? And we eventually got one in Ballyfermot, in the very beginning, so it was just opening. And there was nothing there, no school, no bus, no shop, no church. It shows you needed social housing. What people hadn't learned at that stage was, you don't heap all social housing together. And you don't build houses and don't build community at the same time. It took years to overcome that.
Were you close to your mum and dad?
Yes, yeah, I was, obviously. That from both my parents, I developed a strong, or it was passed on to me, a strong sense of my own worth, that I could look after myself, and that I should look after myself, and not to let anybody push me around. And I can remember when I was going to Rome to work, finally, in this very room, Archbishop Ryan said to me, he said, look, you're always welcome back. He said, well, if you go out to Rome now, you have to fight your own fights. Don't expect me to do anything for you. If you're going to survive in that place, it's the only way. And I could remember saying to somebody years later, I thought he was saying to me, I'm not interested in you. It was the best advice I ever got. And I could say literally that there was no, in the whatever files there are on me in the Vatican, there's no file where I ever asked anybody to do something for me. I had this sense of being able to stand on my own two feet. And my brother as well.
Seamus.
My secretary here, I said to him, do you remember the day I was installed? He said, I do, very well. And I said, why? He said, because you talked about your brother. And you said, my brother and I, we get on extraordinarily well. And that's probably due to the fact that we've always lived 2,000 to 3,000 kilometres away from each other. You know? Because we had the situation that he was in Moscow and I was in the Vatican. And I think the CIA were probably wondering at this increase of telephone conversations from two opposites of the world. Yeah.
Your parents were obviously ambitious for you both. As you say, you grew up in a corporation house.
Ambitious, yeah.
They wanted you to be educated.
There was no doubt about that. You know, that my brother and I were probably the only two boys on our street who would have finished second level education. It doesn't mean that we were the most intelligent. We weren't. Mm-hmm. One of my next door neighbours was probably my own age. You know, it was extremely, you know, done extraordinarily well in life and his family as well. But he just didn't have the opportunity, you know. But he said to me, he said, you know, I used to get your shoes. Because he was when I grew out of the shoes, the neighbour got them. Mm-hmm. And I said, and we used to get cakes across the back garden from your mother. You know, there was that sense of solidarity, which was a great tradition of inner city Dublin. I remember, again, the first time somebody died on the street. What sticks with me now was the neighbours took over. The children were farmed out to different neighbours. Food was provided. The mother was looked after. And she died only about 2 years ago, 190-something, you know. Mm. There was no strategic plan. It just happened.
How and why did you become a priest? I mean, were you a very holy little boy?
I don't think I was, you know, and if I looked holy, I know what I was really like, you know. Religion was part of the family. We weren't very long in Ballyfermot when a nun arrived at the door, a French nun. And she said to my mother, I want you to start a sewing class. And I can remember my mother and my aunt, they were cutting out patterns out of newspapers, mm. you know, helping people to make clothes. In those days, it was cheaper to make clothes. But this nun, she was really an amazing woman. She came and started the sisters there in Ballyfermot. They're little sisters of the Assumption. But then this nun, she brought holy books to my mother and said she had to read them. And then one day she arrived and said, I'm off. I'm going to New Zealand. We want to open a place there. And off she went. And then I heard from her when I was ordained a bishop. She wrote and all sorts of stories about myself and my brother that she remembered. And then a few years later, I got a phone call to say she had died at 105. So, you know, that you can do good and lead a long life. And that was the path that brought me in to be a priest, you know.
Would you become a priest today if you were that young?
I probably would not have been allowed. That was the one thing my parents would probably say, look, you're too young.
How young were you?
I was 17 and a half, you know, mm-hmm. and I came into a seminary, which was a pretty nasty place, really. It was very regimented and rigid and puritanical and so on, you know.
Did you ever nearly leave?
I'd say every 10 years.
You know? Still time.
And then you see that I had the unusual experience. I spent more than half my adult life outside Ireland. In the Vatican, a strange place. But a lot of people think that my affection for Rome is that I go back to the intrigues of cardinals. I go back because I had friends. And I've got friends whose children are my friends and whose grandchildren are my friends. I was very fortunate that I met friends very early on who brought me into their circle. You know, we had a very normal life, you know.
Why wouldn't you retire to Rome now rather than, I know you're moving somewhere else in Dublin, which I won't say.
I would have thought about it. And a lot of my friends in Rome said, you know, you'd be back to us, you know. But, you know, I'm out of Rome now for nearly 20 years. All my health insurance is in Ireland, which is something that you'd have to look at. But I would hope to be able to, if international travel resumes ever, to be able to go back and visit people and travel around parts of Italy that I remember and would like just to go back to.
You know the Vatican so well, yeah. And you clearly have lived a patently good life. But many people think the Vatican, although it's magnificent, is quite corrupt.
There are extraordinarily good people there, and there are people that I would be worried about. Mm. I watched, and came across some nasty intrigues going on a personal level. You know, I had people who, if I did something that attracted sort of recognition, they'd say, "Well, you know, get him out, and we'll do it." You know, it wasn't always nice, but I did meet with extraordinary people, and I learned an awful lot, you know, from them.
Pope Francis is obviously trying to change things, and even his recent statement about gay couples. Yeah. Do you support that?
I support what he said and what he intended to say. It may not be exactly what people are interpreting it to be, because I said something about it. I'm getting lots of rather nasty letters about things. You know? Somebody said to me that a lot of the people who criticise the church really are not believers themselves. You know, mm-hmm. And I said, well, the ones who write to me, they profess themselves believers, particularly in one thing, hell, because they think I'm going to go there.
And is that because, I mean, I suppose his recent announcement to the popes about the need to recognise the unions of gay and lesbian people in loving relationships, for some people within the church, that's obviously too much to take for them.
The Pope's concern is fundamentally about people and people's happiness and people's fulfilment and people's weaknesses. And I'm not saying that about gay and lesbian people, but people weak across the board. Mm. People in all sorts of relationships need stability. You can simply walk away and leave somebody abandoned, mm-hmm. you know, so that legal protection should be there for everybody.
But as you were saying there, you know, you get letters, there is a lot of intolerance. There's also homophobia probably still.
There is, yeah. And you know, I feel that those who come out with homophobic statements may themselves be grappling with their own sexual identity, you know. But, you know, we're coming up now to the publication of the Murphy Report on the mother and baby homes. And, I have a great regard for Judge Murphy. She carried out a difficult investigation into the sexual abuse in this diocese. She rendered a great service to the church by bringing out the truth, you know. But when I look back on that particular period, and all these things go together, the mother and baby homes, the industrial schools, the Magdalene laundries, and I keep saying to myself, where were we? Where was this sort of blindness in society that we didn't that people didn't notice those things?
Was it that they were terrified of the Catholic Church, though?
But they were
because you laid down edicts.
They were part of it as well. You know, that's the thing. And what I keep asking myself is, in 15 years' time, when people look back at us today, what will they be saying? The things we didn't see. Now, I think, for example, particularly the way we look after autistic children and their parents. They can't get a place in a school, you know. So every society has to see where there is this sort of this blindness in our society that we miss things. With the mother and baby, they're not just survivors. In some cases, they're still being victimized, you know. There must be ways. I understand the legal difficulties that are there. They've been there for years, but but we have to find a way of overcoming that so that people can find not just their birth mother, but their it's part of themselves, and the progress is far too slow. I had another occasion when as a young man, this boy he came out of an industrial school, said to me, "Would you be able to find my mother?" You know, mm-hmm. And we did find the mother, and we went to the mother and baby home. And I remember the nun said, that woman had no interest in her child. But we kept going and going and going. And then one day we arrived in to the snug of a pub in a rural town and asked to see this woman. And in she came. She was elderly. She was terrified. And she was cleaning the place and she had a blackberry in her hand, which she kept fingering. And we said to her, "Do you ever remember a little boy?" And her face lit up. And you could see on her face, he's alive. Somebody knows him. Somebody's looking after him. And, you know, it sticks in my mind, that woman. Now, it didn't work out. You know, that neither he nor her really had the ability to bond. But it wasn't that she wasn't interested in her baby. That baby was there all the time in her mind, you know.
And I can see how moved you are by that. Yeah. I mean, you were crying thinking of that story. But and yet,
that's many years ago. And I still, I don't know. Many people maybe wanted to give up their baby, but because of the circumstances that they were in. Some may feel now that they were forced to give up their baby. I don't know exactly what happened at the time. The Murphy Commission will verify some of these things. But that expression on that lady's face, it was.
And I can see that humanity in you. And yes, at the beginning of that story, you mentioned the nun who basically said that mother had no interest in her child, which was patently untrue and cruel.
Yeah, there were two different ways of expressing the same reality in a sense. But you know,
there was a
harshness in Irish society and in the Irish Church. And that is one of the things that Pope Francis said when he was in Ireland, meeting with the Irish bishops. He warned them to keep away from a harsh, judgmental church which had done so much damage in the past.
Yeah? And it was harsh on all people, in a sense, the Catholic Church. But it was particularly harsh as well on women, in a sense, you know, women I know of an older generation will say they may as well have thrown themselves into the local river if they got pregnant. But the guy who got them pregnant went on often to marry the best girl in the village.
Yeah, and left them, abandoned them, you know. Yeah. And that the judgmentalism of Victorianism mixed with the judgmentalism of the church, but I would say particularly of some church people, you know. But again, you know, I don't want to be judging other people, but I keep asking myself now, as I come to a late stage in my own life, how can we ensure that we're not doing the same thing? We have the same blindness to other things in Irish society.
Do you think a slimmed down Catholic Church that you're now so much part of is a kinder church, or are you a lone ranger? In other words,
no, I don't think. I've never looked at my. Sometimes people say to me, "Are you a lone ranger?" I am myself. And that, again, is what I said, what I got from my parents. Be yourself. When I lived in Rome, I had far more contact with ordinary life and my friends. You know, I don't know today who is my friend, whether it's him or his wife, you know, that we became so close to one another. I could spend days in this place and never meet a woman. You know, and you have to be very careful that you lose a sensitivity to that presence. You know, and you can become very clerical in yourself, you know.
Do you ever think back and think that you might like to have got married and had children?
You know, I've often met priests who said, I'd love to have children. If I wanted to children, I'd like to have children with a woman, with that woman. Obviously, you feel loneliness, but there are many people who are married and are lonely. There are many people out there who are lonely for other reasons. There are many people out there who feel abandoned. But I mean, I have to say, compared to any of those, I've lived a privileged life. I find now, particularly in the difficult situation that the church is in, and the pandemic and so on, that it's one of the first times I feel frustrated that I'm not able to do what I want to do. I wasn't able to go out. And my energies are not the ones that they should be. But I said to the Pope, I said, look, I think the challenges that the church in Dublin is facing, it's not a job for an aging person. And I got a good answer from him. He said, are you talking about me? You know, I know it's time to move on. I know it's time for the priests, the people of Dublin need a younger leader, a generational change. And I've got confidence in a particular generation of the Dublin priests. They're extraordinary, close to people. They're there beside the poor. They're there to with the bereaved. and they're preaching and living the word of God. You know, they're a different generation to me, and they will bring, you know, what's good in their generation.
You celebrated your 75th birthday here in lockdown during the first time, which was, I suppose, lonely in itself. You submitted your resignation letter to the Pope as required. Do you know yet, Archbishop, when that will take effect?
I had hoped, and the Pope and I had spoken about it, and what I said to the Pope was, I think it would not be a good idea to have delay, to have speculation. There are too many things to do. Unfortunately, it hasn't worked out as I wanted. I hope that very soon I'd be able to get somebody else who can come in and, you know, get at it, and doing the things, you know, that I don't have the energy to do at the moment.
Have you been consulted about who might succeed you?
Oh, various people, and I know all the rumours better than more than anybody else.
Tell us them.
You know, and
who's going to be you?
I don't know, because it has to be decided. But
do you have a preference?
Yes, but he wouldn't want it.
Can you say who it is?
No, I've no idea. I mean, one of the strange things is, I found a book yesterday when I was moving my books, and I'd forgotten about this. That man said to me, about 3 weeks before I was appointed to Dublin, he said, if you want to get out of Dublin, you better move quickly, because they're going ahead with it. These things happen, and you just... I didn't expect to come back to Dublin. I remember going to Rome with my secretary at the time, and we were coming into the city, and I pointed to that hospital. He said, I thought I was going to die in that hospital. And he said, did you have serious illness? I said, that's where people from the Vatican die. That's why I thought I was going to die and be buried, you know.
So when are you going to get out of here? Do you know?
I would hope that before Christmas, the appointment, the nomination of the successor would be there. And if that happens, then it's just a matter of you know, letting the new man come in and start.
Will you be happy to leave?
I'd be, you know, when you come to the end of a particular period in your life, you know, if you're happy to leave, then you weren't happy in the job. Remember when I was appointed Mary McAleese as president, she said to me, give you one bit of advice, enjoy it. If you can't enjoy it, you shouldn't be doing it.
And did you enjoy it?
I did, yeah. I enjoyed, I mean, everybody would admit I was bishop in a difficult time, but I enjoyed meeting people, and I enjoyed serving people. I know, and I've had expressions of recognition from so many people for what I've tried to do. And again, that other word appears, affection.
Archbishop, thanks so much. Thank you for being my guest this morning. And I wish you the very best of luck in your retirement.
Thanks very much. Yeah.